in reviewing the last minute or so of the previous tape in order to find out where I left off, I noticed that I said there that we arrived in Australia about August 15th, 1941, and of course everybody will recognize that was an error by 1 year. It was August 1942, of course. I don't remember a great deal about our stay in Sydney, except that it was not very long, 2 days perhaps. I do remember one amusing incident, which had to do with the fact that we had, several of us had gone into some large office building in downtown Sydney. This office building was surrounded by sandbags and things, and then it had a huge big door, which was so big that it was seldom used, and you went in and out through a little bitty door set inside of the big door. And the point of this was that when we came out, in order to get through the little door, you had to bend over about double to get through it. It was so low. And I thought that the person who was going out just in front of me was Joe Hensler. So when he bent way over and was going through the door, I pinched his ass. And the person whose ass I had pinched said in a loud voice, "Don't do that to me." And much was my chagrin when I emerged myself to find it was not Joe Hensler at all, but some army captain that I had never set eyes on in my life before. However, he took it in good part, and everybody just had a laugh, though I don't think perhaps anybody but the captain and I knew what had happened. Anyway, that happened. I also once remember being in a taxi cab in the back seat with some of my friends, and in the front seat was an army captain of some kind, unknown to the rest of us, but he was taking us somewhere or something. But anyway, I said something out loud about the fact that I had noticed some P-38s on board some of the ships in the harbor. And he became very disturbed at that and put his finger up to his lips, and meaning, don't talk about stuff like that in public, in front of the taxi driver, of course. It was the first taste I'd really had of the need to keep your mouth shut. I think now is as good a time as any to give a quick review of what the situation was in Australia at that time, as far as the military were concerned. Of course, what had happened was that what little remnants there were of the Army Air Corps, as it was still called at that time, in the Philippines, made their way island by island down through the East Indies islands, Borneo and Sumatra and Java and Timor and all those places, down to Australia. Almost no airplanes made it by that time, no fighter planes, I mean, made it, though a number of B-17s did. There were some other little airplanes, too, which didn't belong to the U.S., and I'll come to that later. But, in fact, the Japanese had driven the Allies out of everywhere, right down to the shores of Australia. In Australia, most of whose troops were in British service in North Africa and India and God knows where else, Australia had very little to defend herself with and was in great terror of being invaded. Now, that wasn't so funny. The Japanese had pretty well established themselves in the Southwest and South Pacific and were, as everybody well knows, firmly entrenched on Guadalcanal and all the rest of the Solomon Islands. Now, things took a turn in May 1942 with the Battle of the Coral Sea, when the Americans, with two aircraft carriers, one cruiser, and two Australian cruisers, set out to stop the Japanese from making a landing on Australia. The Japanese had three aircraft carriers and some other vessels and were on their way down to invade northern Australia. So the Americans took them on there at the Battle of the Coral Sea. It was one of those odd battles, odd by standards of those days anyhow, that during the entire course of that battle, neither side saw the other. That is to say, nobody on the American ships saw any of the Japanese ships and vice versa. The only people who saw the enemy were the pilots in the airplanes. Well, it was a famous battle because the Americans ended up by sinking one Japanese cruiser. They damaged several other ships and shot down 80 aircraft. On the American side, the USS Lexington was sunk, and the Americans lost 66 aircraft. But the point of it all was that the Japanese didn't have enough left to pursue their original goal, and they turned around and went back where, I don't know. That was, again, in May 1942, while I was still in advanced flying school. The Japanese then decided that they would try to make a landing on northern Australia in the vicinity of the town of Darwin, which is on the northwest coast, north coast really, but on the western side more or less of Australia, because they could fly down there to Darwin from Timor without a great deal of trouble, even though it was all over water. They could even get down there with fighter escort, and they proceeded to do that. The town of Darwin was evacuated of civilians, and it was held as best they could with what few aircraft there were around until a little bit later. When the Americans took over the defense of Darwin. And in thinking about all this while I'm talking, I've made another error, because it's obvious from looking at the calendar that the Japanese had begun their assault on Darwin well before the Battle of the Coral Sea. And the reason I know that is because one of the fighter groups that I became associated with, and which I'll go into in more detail later, was already sent to Darwin in early spring, in mid-spring of 1942. And they took over the defense of it. Anyway, the point is, mostly, that the Americans didn't have anything in Australia to speak of. And if I am not mistaken, on the vessel with us coming over from San Francisco, the SS Mount Vernon, were most of the troops, or a large part of the infantry that constituted, I think, the U.S. 32nd Division, which was being sent over to Australia to help assume some of the defense role over there. It didn't have any airplanes to speak of. There were some B-17s, which, as I said, had worked their way down through the East Indies and were in sorry shape. But they were there. They didn't dare, for the most part, keep them up in New Guinea at all because they would be lost. So when the bombers made raids, they had to fly from New Guinea up, from Australia up to New Guinea and then do their work and then come back to Australia. There were some fighter outfits there, mostly with P-39s salvaged more or less out of what was left over after the Louisiana maneuvers in 1940. They weren't in very good shape. There was no 5th Air Force at this time when I arrived, though that was about to change. I don't know what all the U.S. had there in the way of bombers, but they had some B-17s from the old 19th Bomb Group out of the Philippines. There were some guys there with the 22nd Bomb Group who had B-26s, but only a handful of them, and there were some A-20s. I don't know who had them. There wasn't much of anything. For fighter strength, there were 3 fighter groups. There was the 8th Fighter Group, composed of the 35th, the 36th, and the 80th Fighter Squadrons, which, when I first arrived, were still called Pursuit Squadrons and Pursuit Groups. They flew P-39s. There was the 35th Pursuit Group, composed of the 39th, the 40th, and the 41st Pursuit Squadrons. They flew P-39s. And there was the 49th Fighter Group, made up of the 7th, 8th, and 9th Fighter Squadrons, and they flew P-40s. Nobody was in very good shape when they got there to fight, in that nobody had any training, of course. But worse than that, most of the pilots had no experience flying fighters at all. Of course, none of those of us who came over in the present story had any fighter experience. And I have read, furthermore, that when the 49th Fighter Group arrived in Australia in January 1942, 95 out of 102 pilots had never flown a fighter plane in their lives. So the U.S. and the Australians were doing what they could to get a foothold in Australia. They lost out in the Battle of the Coral Sea, but they were still hammering at Darwin. And in the second place, they had landed huge numbers of troops on the northern coast of New Guinea. And because New Guinea is, the north coast of New Guinea is separated by very high mountains, sometimes over 15,000 feet, separated from the southern coast, the Japanese decided to march their troops across the island through extremely dense jungle, over the mountain and down into Port Moresby. And from there they were going to continue their takeoff down to Australia. And it was along about this point that I and my friends from Spence Field arrived. I think I've already answered any question that might be in your minds as to why they would send people over there to fly fighter planes who had no experience in fighter planes. Well, it's because neither did anybody else. It's all they had. And they were down to grabbing people out of flying school, out of the graduating class, and sending them into combat without any practice at all, really. And they did it because they had to. especially in that theater. Anybody that was good for anything was being sent to Africa, I suppose. I don't think at this stage we were sending anything to England in the way of pilots. Anyway, that's what things were like. And while we were in Brisbane, the Air Corps did something which I never heard of being done before or since. And again, it's an indication of the state of desperation they were in. They called all of us together, all of the pilots who could come over on the Mount Vernon, and said, look, we know that you've only gone to single-engine flying school and trained presumably as fighter pilots, but our need is so great that you can right now make a choice. Any of you who want to go to bombers and multi-engine aircraft, raise your hands. And those who want to stick with fighters may do so. So about half of our group, including old Charlie Smith and including Joe Hensler, volunteered to go into bombers. And their choice was approved, and they were sent up north to B-17s. Well, we were sent up north too. What they thought they were sending us up north to, I'm not quite sure. But we were all piled on a train and went up, and we got up north of Brisbane somewhere. I don't know where, but somewhere during this several-day train journey up the coast of Australia. Somebody down in Sydney or Melbourne realized that whereas the brand new bomber pilots could make out all right because they would only be flying in the right-hand seat anyway and could receive, shall we call it, on-the-job training, the fighter pilots couldn't possibly do that, and they had to be given at least some fighter plane experience before they were sent to New Guinea. So somewhere on the line up there, along the line north of Brisbane, we were pulled off the train and sent back down to a little place called Williamtown, New South Wales, which is north of Brisbane by, I don't know what, 30 miles. That isn't right. I'm wrong. It's north of Sydney. North of Sydney by about 30 miles. And I repeat, this place is called Williamtown, not Williamstown. There's no S in it. It's Williamtown. And it is now one of the big, I'm told, RAAF bases in Australia. But when we arrived there, there was nobody there at all except us. That's not literally true. There was a staff. They had some people working in the kitchen to cook food. But I swear to God, beyond that, I can't think of anybody, any Australians that were on that base. It was a big base. Fair number of barracks, nice, big, long, paved runways, out in the country all by itself. Nothing around, and it was, oh, a few miles, 5 miles or something of the sort, north of a town called Newcastle. I think they used to mine coal there. So, sometime we arrived at this godforsaken little place called Williamtown, and we made ourselves home in the barracks. It was a place of constantly shifting sand, and the floors were all had little piles of sand in the corners and so on, but it wasn't a bad place. There was a control tower and some hangars, but nobody in the control tower. That was empty, and we sort of took it over ourselves, though there was nothing you could do with this control tower in that we had no radios. There was no radio in the tower, and there were no radios in the airplanes. But we did have a flare pistol, and we established somebody up there on a permanent basis when flying was going on, so that he could, if you were about to land with your wheels up, fire a flare and warn you to double check. The orders which we left Sydney with were dated August 15, 1942, headed United States Army Services of Supplies, Southwest Pacific Area, Base Section 7, APO 927. Pursuant to instructions, the Commanding General, USAAS, APO 501, the following Air Corps officers now casually at this headquarters will proceed by first-class rail on or about 15 August 42 from Sydney, New South Wales, to Townsville, Queensland. Upon arrival thereat, they will report to the Air Officer Commanding, Army Air Forces, Northeast Area, for assignment. The travel directed is necessary in the military service. The transportation service will furnish the necessary transportation. Well, these were then replaced on August 18th with a set of orders which read, the following named Air Corps officers now casually at this headquarters will proceed by first-class rail on or about 19 August from Brisbane, Queensland, to Williamtown, New South Wales, for the purpose of pursuing a course of instruction at the OTU, that stands for Operational Training Unit, number 2. Upon arrival thereat, they will report to the commanding officer, OTU number 2, for further instructions. There were 34 of us, I believe, and among them was old Snuffy Dorton was there. I knew all of these people well by this time. Don Raines was there, one of them. Snuffy Smith was one of them. Bob Green was one of them. Anyway, we went up there. And it would be hard to describe the people who were sent there to teach us. A few of them I don't remember, but I remember the main ones. In command was a major, Air Corps major, by the name of Oswald Lundy. People called him Ozzy, though I always called him Major Lundy, and so did the rest of us flunkies. He was one of those people who had been run out of the Philippines, island by island, and like everybody else in command at this unit, was battle-happy, as we called it. There was a doctor there who was as loony as a March hare, but quite delightful. He was very funny and dressed up in costume all the time and went around. And I have to tell a story about him, one day he just got the notion in his head that he was going to give all of us pilots a flight examination. Well, in the first place, I doubt that he had enough equipment with him to give a proper flight examination. In the second place, I'm not even sure that he knew how, but maybe he did. Anyway, he took it into his head that he was going to do it. Now, one of the tests you took on these flight exams was a thing called a Schneider. What it consisted of, I don't know. I think it was some blood reading or something. Who knows? It wasn't anything you had to do. But anyway, I don't remember the exact figures, but it doesn't matter. When he took my Schneider, the reading was 18 or something, shall we say. And he looked at me and he said, Good God, boy, he said, when it gets as high as 10, you're supposed to be dead. Well, I wasn't dead or anywhere close to it. There were a couple of second lieutenants there, one of whose name I forget, but he was a real asshole. Boy, was he a shit. He was one of the meanest, nastiest thing. I remember, this is typical of him, I remember when they gave me some instructions to do something or other, and we had some enlisted men there who were mechanics. And he told me to that something was to be done, and I said, should I tell him, meaning this mechanic, something or other? And he looked at me and straightened up, and he said, no, don't ask him. He said, tell him. And that was his attitude towards everybody. And he treated people like dirt. You can imagine when the way he treated us, the way he treated enlisted men. But most of those guys were all right. There was another colorful character who was somewhat famous over the years. Certainly was in the Philippine Islands anyway. He was a captain by the name of Jesus Villamore. And he had distinguished himself on several occasions in the past, fighting off the Japanese while they were still in the Philippine Islands. He flew back there P-26s, and probably most people don't even know what a P-26 was. I don't think I ever saw one. But they were made by Boeing, and they were fabric-colored fighter planes with a gun in the nose, like World War I. Or maybe they had two guns in the nose, I don't know. Open cockpit. And I can't remember whether they were low-wing monoplanes or biplanes, but that's what they were flying up there, and Villamore had a squadron of P-26s. And when he was quite certain in his mind that the Japanese were going to invade, he, among other things, had piled up lots of empty 50-gallon oil drums at the end of each end of the runway. It was just a dirt strip anyhow, in such a way that once they pulled out the chocks, these cans would all roll down and roll out on the field and keep the Japanese from landing on it. But like everybody else, eventually they ran out of airplanes over there and were taken up by the infantry and spent their time in the jungle fighting with the infantry, and they somehow managed to get out, I don't know. Anyway, this Jess Villamore, they called him Jess, he was a very colorful character, and he didn't always know as much English as he might have. He was going on and on one day about some woman, some flying officer's wife, who had also got out of the Philippines, God knows how, but she was down in Sydney, Australia, and Jess said of her, he said, look at her down there in Sydney, sleeping with this one and sleeping with that one, never the same two one night after another, and there is her husband up in New Guinea dying like flies. Another time, Jess was doing something with his left hand, and somebody said, Jess said, I didn't know you were left-handed. He said, I'm not left-handed, I'm amphibious. Well, they used to give us lectures about aerial combat, and I remember Jess would always say, well, you'll get up there the first few times and you'll be mealing around and you won't know what you're doing and you won't know what anybody else is doing, and they'll be shooting at you and you'll be shooting at them and you'll be mealing around and it'll all be a big mess. I suppose so. Anyway, he was a jolly fella and people liked him. Major Lundy, the CO, was also a very nice fellow, even though he told me once that I taxied like old people fucked. Airplanes. There was one P-40 there, which we were not allowed to fly, and it was practically brand new. And that was for Major Lundy and some of the others to fly, though they seldom did it. For our purposes, we had two airplanes. There were P-39s, which were beat up beyond belief, and we wrecked several of them while we were there. They had been worn out years ago. They had no radios in them. They had nothing in them much, and it's a miracle they even flew, but we had a few. We must have had five or six of those things, I suppose. The other airplane we had was something called a Curtiss Falcon, and that was built by the Curtiss Company for the Dutch Air Force. And they had come down to Australia out of the East Indies, Timor or Java or someplace. It was a low-wing, all-metal monoplane, single engine, of course. And all the placarding in the aircraft was in Dutch and in metrics, and you couldn't read any of the things. So you never knew how high you were, how fast you were going, or anything like that, and you didn't know what any of the levers did, because all the words on the placard seemed to me to consist of never less than 10 letters, and generally 15.